So hello everybody and welcome. This is Pinky from PinkyMcKay.com and I'm welcoming you all to our call, The Secrets of Happy Babies. I am so excited to have so many of you here today. Did you know I've just counted and there are almost 2,200 people of you from all over the world. We have people from Africa, Germany, France, Canada, the United States, New Zealand and people from the UK also registered, but I expect, seeing it's very early there at the moment, most of you will be hearing the recorded version of this call, unless you're up feeding your baby. And if you are, I always thought when my babies were little, it was a bit like sisters in the night. I used to think that, you know, that if I looked out the window or I looked across the world, there'd be other lights perhaps on or women sitting in the dark just nursing their babies too. So you're definitely not alone tonight. And there's also a lot of people on the line or on their laptops from Australia, which is where I live. And it's such a privilege to be able to connect with you all and feel that we can support each other for the well-being of babies everywhere. Now, although we're going to give you a wealth of information today, we can't possibly cover every aspect about infant development on just a one-hour call. So this call is an introduction to a fabulous four-week series of teleseminars. And if you love this call and you want to dive deeper, I'll be telling you later on this morning or this afternoon or whatever time it is in your country how you can do this. I just realised Tracy's in Canada and it's 8 p.m. at night and I'm in Australia and it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
So it's all different times now.
It is, yeah. So whatever time you are listening to this, I'll tell you later on in the call what you can expect and who the guests for this series will be. Now, just a little bit of housekeeping. If you're listening on your computers, you'll notice a little box to send in questions. While I'm happy for you to send in questions, I won't be answering any questions today because and neither will Tracy, because we're probably just doubling up on some of the information that will be covered in the longer series, and also we don't have a lot of time. It's pretty important to get through what we need to get through right now. But if you do want to send a question in that fits with one of our expert interviews that are coming up, it would be great if you email that. So you can email it to pinky@pinkymckay.com.au if you would like to, or go onto my website and just find the email address. You could even do it on my Facebook page if you like, but it's better to have it there than racing through on the screen here because they race on and they race off. So if you do have questions that you can think of when we tell you who the guests are, that's fine. You know, it'd be a lovely opportunity to ask questions on behalf of you. Now, if you're all comfortable and your little ones are happy or happy enough, let's go. So first, I'll introduce myself and I'll give you a little bit of background of what inspired me to organise these teleseminars. Then I'm going to introduce Tracy Cassell, who is our guest. She's a psychologist from Canada and I'll introduce a bit more about her in a moment. So my most important role is being a mum of five healthy, happy adults and a grandmother to three beautiful little people. So I'm very hands-on with real babies and toddlers right now. I'm an international board-certified lactation consultant, a baby massage instructor, and I run a busy private practice in Melbourne. So I have this beautiful job of visiting parents in their own homes and sharing that special new baby time with them as we just help them smooth out some of the little creases in what might be happening with babies, and certainly no baby training. And I also write about mothering and babies. I write for Essential Baby website and My Child magazine here in Australia, as well as several publications in other countries. I'm just about to start writing for Little Treasures in New Zealand because I used to write for Littlies magazine and that's now closed down. I'm a best-selling author of five books and they include Parenting by Heart, 100 Ways to Calm the Crying, Sleeping Like a Baby and Toddler Tactics. And for those of you not in Australia, they are now available on Amazon and on Apple. And I'm really proud that all my books are approved by the Australian Breastfeeding Association and LHA League International. And my book, Sleeping Like a Baby and 100 Ways to Calm the Crying, are recommended in the Australian Infant Mental Health Association Policy on Controlled Crying. So that means that the information in them is all approved and evidence-based and it's supportive of breastfeeding and practices that encourage optimum infant mental health. I also speak to a lot of groups and parents and professionals, but it's my work with parents that is my driving force and what inspired me to offer this tele-series. Now, I feel so blessed to be sharing this special time with families, and I often say a mother with a baby in her arms and a smile on her face is my goal, And it's so rewarding to hear mothers say, I am really enjoying my baby. But I also see a lot of parents in utter despair. And there's an incredible level of anxiety around parenting. And sadly, this seems to be driven or pushed. It's like a tsunami, somebody else said the other night. I was talking to another baby person who said it just seems like a tsunami. And also a lot of nonsense. There's a lot of rules and there's a lot of nonsense that makes parenting incredibly difficult if you don't have that cookie cutter type of baby that does seem to be pretty easy and follow the rules that are there. And some babies do. You don't have to train some babies. They just naturally fit in. But the babies who haven't read those books or who don't seem to fit in, it can be confusing. I actually love what Professor James McKenna says, you know, the babies that are the least compliant to this training stuff, it's not quite his words, but he said they're the most well adapted for survival. And I like that. So Tracy will be talking a bit about that. So one of the things I'm noticing is that often what parents are anxious about is actually normal behaviour of a bright, healthy, well-attached baby. But because of people getting into their heads with misinformation, they're feeling undermined and questioning their parenting choices. And that's why today I'm interviewing one of the most appropriate professionals I know to not only give you the science, but also the wisdom and confidence to nurture your baby in a way that will really boost that little brain and equip your little one for a foundation of social, emotional, and intellectual development. Now let's call that the happiness factor. So our guest today is Tracy Cassells. Welcome, Tracy.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And Tracy, as well as being a mum, if you were on the call at the beginning before we actually started, you'll hear she's got a little toddler.
Yes, three.
Three, right. Yes. A three-nager.
Exactly. And she very, very much is.
And Tracy's the primary writer for the brilliant website evolutionaryparenting.com. So if you have a look at that later, you can get a wealth of information about parenting and baby and childcare. And it's all thoroughly researched and evidence-based. Now, Tracy is a developmental and clinical psychologist. She obtained her BA in cognitive science from the University of Columbia. University of California, Berkeley.
That's okay.
A master's degree in clinical psychology from the University of British Columbia. And she's currently a PhD candidate in developmental psychology, also at the University of British Columbia, where she is studying how certain evolutionary factors affect children's empathic behaviour. Tracy also spent time working at the Canadian Council on Learning, a non-profit agency dedicated to researching myriad elements of learning across the lifespan. And most importantly, she's mother to daughter Madeline and wife to husband Brian. So again, a big welcome, Tracy.
Thank you so much.
And first up, can you just tell us a little bit about your journey and evolutionary parenting? How did that all sort of melt together for you?
Well, that was actually something I honestly never had any intention of doing, which sounds a little weird now because I can't imagine doing anything else now except that. But it was when I had my daughter. So after giving birth, despite the fact that the type of parenting that I promote and do myself with my daughter, we still co-sleep, she still breastfeeds, she was baby-worn everywhere. We did all of these things. They were incredibly natural to me because my mother did most of them. Most with me, if not all, and then all with my sister, who's much younger than I am. So I witnessed this growing up. I kind of saw the effect of this type of parenting on a baby's general level of happiness, of outgoingness, of building resiliency, independence. So, but once I had my daughter, I kind of had more of a scientific interest in all of it. And I started reading more books and reading articles. And, you know, we get a one-year mat leave here, which also extends when you're in school. So I took the full year with my daughter and was just reading this stuff. And she was about 6 months old, and we had gone to one of the islands around here in BC, Salt Spring Island, my husband and I, over Christmas. And I think I had probably said enough to him that he just finally said, you need to write this down for other people. And I was like, well, no one else is interested in it. And then he gave me the look that said, do you really think I am? And that was, I know he was. He was very interested in all of it. But, I mean, the poor man had his ear talked off for 6 months and even before because of the natural birth and everything that I would speak to him about as we were planning it. And he just said, just try it. Just start writing, and if nothing ever happens with it and it goes nowhere, then so be it. And if 5 people read it and they get something out of it, then great. And if 10 people read it or 100 and I thought he was crazy, I thought no one else in the world was interested in all of this stuff, but I started writing. And it just slowly seemed to kind of build. There was never a big moment of suddenly things changed. It's just more and more people seemed to start to be interested in it and want to talk about it and comment on it. And so for the last, we really started EP in May of 2011. My goodness, I can't do my math anymore. May of 2011, so it's been just over 2 years, and it's just been a constant steady build to now we have, you know, regular people reading it and interested in it, and, I mean, here I am talking to you about it, and there's enough people that want to hear about it some more, so it's absolutely amazing to me that we have these people, and I really feel kind of hope that from that, that there actually may be a shift happening in the way people are viewing babies, are viewing parenting, and are viewing families most, you know, first and foremost, because it really is an entire family process to raise a child. So that has been, and we're, you know, where we are now, continuing to write and do things, and it's just been wonderful.
And it's a beautiful resource. Do you want to, I was just thinking, I haven't really got it as a formal question, but I'm just wondering, evolutionary parenting and attachment parenting, and I was really interested in how you said your mother did this with you and did it with your sister, because I find so often when I visit parents, and it's often the mums who are struggling with the voices in their head from outside saying you shouldn't do this, and when we ask, you know, how did your mother nurture you? They've been imprinted, I'm sure. It's not just even a conscious watching. Some of these girls are, or ladies, I should say, are only children. They haven't watched mm-hmm. a younger sibling, but this is how they've been nurtured, and it really does seem to be a natural process for them to want to do the same.
Yeah, and I absolutely think it had a huge influence on me. My mom was, first and foremost, she was really a natural birth advocate, so actually she spent a lot of time fighting in Ontario, Canada, where I was born, fighting to get, you can't say legalized, but to allow midwives to attend home births without prosecution. So technically you could always give birth at home, but if a midwife was the only one in attendance at the time that I was born and my brother was born, they could be fined and jailed for it. And she fought with a lot of other women to help change that, to help change the landscape. So she was always actively involved in that, and naturally for her, we were all full-term breastfed. When I was little, sleep was one area that was slightly different. For me, I was fully in the crib alone in a room. My brother, who's between my sister and I, she kind of, partway through, she started that way and then learned he needed someone just to lie with him to fall asleep. So she started doing that, and then my sister actually co-slept with my mom exclusively for quite a few years, and then on and off till she was about 11, 12. She would start in her own bed. They had rooms next to each other, and my sister would just come in and join my mom in bed partway through the night, so they would almost inevitably wake up together. And for anyone who's concerned that, you know, suddenly you're going to have a child who's completely dependent and you're told everything's going to go horribly wrong, my sister is a lovely, wonderful, highly independent, intelligent 20-year-old at the moment who lives on her own and does everything. So people really don't need to worry about that in the long term scheme of things. She was allowed to leave when she did. And, you know, I really saw the bonding that they had with that because she is so much younger than I am. And it really struck a chord, not only seeing how it was for me feeling comfortable having a mom that nurturing, but then also witnessing it with my brother and sister.
Mm. Yeah, so you're surrounded with it. And that's right, you know that they grow up, and some of the, just a reassurance to the people that have these Velcro babies who are so needy. My mm-hmm. daughter, who was my biggest Velcro baby, just called. She's flying from Australia to Cancun in Mexico tomorrow, coming back Tuesday. She's just going for a ball for the weekend.
Oh, nice. Well, I wish I could do that. Can I join her?
I know. I was thinking, oh, can I hop in your bag? It's only cake and carry on, you know, a ball dress and a change of undies or something like that. Yeah. A bikini, I think so.
Oh, my God. Wonderful.
But that was the child who hung on to me like for dear life. And she was my youngest to go overseas at 21 all by herself. So
exactly.
It really puts a sting in that, you know, it's really nice, I think, for people with little children who are quite still quite needy to know that they let go, and when they let go, they step away.
Yeah, and they do it so confidently. They're not nervous. They're very secure, not only in themselves, but also that I think they really get that sense that if something goes wrong, well, no, they know they can always come back to you.
Yeah.
There's no fear about approaching home again or approaching mom or approaching dad because they have that sense of security there.
Mm. Well, even when you're going, you know, from your younger teenagers, my youngest son, I've got 18 years between my oldest and my youngest, by the way.
Wow.
My youngest one, actually, I got breathalyzed in my pajamas one night because my kid had rung me to say that the person who was supposed to be driving him home had been drinking. Could I come and pick him up? And it was just great that he could ring me up at midnight and I popped in the car and went and got him.
Wonderful.
It was a very funny experience.
Kids don't do that.
Sitting there in my pajamas with three kids laughing at me.
But, you know, the fact is that so many kids wouldn't do that. That was, you know, one of those things.
None of the other kids did it. You know, I ended up taking a carload home because they didn't ring their parents. So there's a basis. Now, back to these babies.
Yes.
We're talking
about how they run off to babies.
Can you describe for our listeners what is your definition of a happy baby?
Well, I want to start by actually saying what I think it's not, because I think there's a massive misconception out there, is that I think when you ask a lot of people what's a happy baby, they say a baby that's not crying or that doesn't cry very often. And, well, I think that's a natural gut reaction to have and something we hope for. And you hear these articles, babies don't cry in Africa and all these things. It's the fact of the matter is that there are legitimate reasons why a baby, a happy baby, can cry and legitimate reasons why a baby might not cry and not be happy. So I think first in terms of the happy baby who cries is we all know, at least I can't imagine not knowing a family who hasn't had a baby who's had reflux, tongue tie, food intolerances, colic, I mean, which we know tends to fall really under the other things, but sometimes we just simply don't know what's wrong and they cry. And that does not mean these babies are unhappy. And I really don't like the idea that there are parents out there who have a baby like this and really feel that they're worried that they have this unhappy baby, because I think they don't, provided they're providing that child with a lot of responsiveness and love and care, especially during the most painful and trying periods. Similarly, I think you can have a baby who is silent and sits there quite passively, but if they're doing it because they've been trained to do that, not because they're inherently happy and quiet, then again, I don't think we have a happy baby despite there being the lack of what we would say observable outside distress signaling in terms of crying. So to me, I prefer to think of happiness as a more longer-term state as opposed to an in-the-moment one. And I think of babies who are, regardless of whether they're in pain more frequently than others because of certain medical conditions, regardless of whether they are high needs or low needs, but they're babies that are respected as their own people by the people that care for them, as their own person. They're treated with empathy, they're treated with care, and they're treated most importantly with responsiveness to their needs, that people don't dismiss them out of hand. And I think in the long term and the short term, you have babies that are generally quite happy with that. And just one little anecdote that kind of highlighted it for me. When my daughter was 4 months old, we went on a trip to Hawaii out here, and we were on a boat, and I saw a family with a toddler. And this kid was, honest to goodness, he was about two and looked to be probably the happiest child I've seen in ages. I mean, just ecstatically happy. And seemed so easy with the parents. Like, we were on this long boat trip together, and we started talking, and I just said, my God, he looks incredibly happy, like, how lucky. And she said, oh no, it was not always like this. And I thought, what? And she said, he had really bad reflux. I would cry and cry and cry as a baby. And she said, you know, we just would have to lie down and sleep with him. We held him the whole time. I was breastfeeding. You know, in essence, she did everything that I think you and I would tell a mother that, as hard as it may be, you should be trying to do to comfort that baby. And as soon as he got out of it, she said, suddenly it was like a whole new child. They finally, he got old enough and found, I guess, a medication that worked for it. And he was this beaming, happy baby. And I think that happiness was always there. It wasn't that he became happy. He was always happy because he was given the response and care that he needed at that time. And finally, when the pain went away, the rest of it could kind of come through. So So I think that's where we need to be thinking about babies in terms of the long-term happiness, and that that reflects what truly is a happy baby.
And I think that's really important, that anecdote, because those babies, and I had one of those myself, my third child. She's actually a psychologist now, by the way.
Oh.
And she works with children. That third baby who...
I wonder where she got that from.
Funny that. She actually works with some big children at the moment, like high school kids, but teenagers. But
they're kind of like babies at times.
She was... Oh, well, she's done littlies too. But she was actually my baby, what I call the Velcro baby, and very much like that baby you described. And I always say to people, the thing is, you cannot shortchange these babies. You know, had she been an easier baby being the third child, she might have spent a little bit more time with a little less attention. Who knows? But I had to wear her in a sling, and I used to pop her in a sling with a poncho over both of us. And when, like you say, when she came out of it, it turned out she was allergic to citrus, and I'd been eating citrus, and that, you know, sort of seemed to be the trigger for a lot of her refluxy behaviour. But, you know, she was also a clingy baby, and just when they get out of it, you just go, well, you know, at least you've loved them through it all.
Exactly, and it gives them that sense, and I think that's what gives them that foundation of happiness and long-term happiness, is that they really, they feel so secure in who they are and that they're worthy of being loved, even despite all of those hard times. And I think that's really important for our babies to have.
That's right. So you've pretty much told us now, what do they really need to be happy, haven't you?
I didn't quite. Yes, I did. They, you know, in really short terms, it's a responsive caregiver.
Yeah.
It's parents who truly respond to their needs. And I think where we get caught up at times is sometimes people think, well, what does responsiveness look like? And there's certain general guidelines you can say, you know, don't leave them to cry, but specifically what each child needs is going to be slightly different. You know, I've heard of babies who get into a carrier and they're miserable. They might need to be held in arms where the specific carriers, or you might need to try four or five different carriers if they need to be close to you to see what works. But it's really, you know, it really comes down to each individual family and what that responsiveness looks like to them. But that responsiveness itself is truly, I think, the key to having that long-term happy baby.
Getting to know that particular baby, isn't it? It's being present enough to know your baby.
Exactly. You have to, and that's, I guess, what responsiveness is really it's responding to that particular baby, not someone else's baby and not what a book tells you your baby should be. But your baby, and because you're the only one who spends that time with them, you're really the only one who's well equipped to learn that, and it is a learning process. You're not, you know, your baby's not born and you suddenly know exactly what they need. It's constant attention to their cues and figuring out, unfortunately, often through trial and error.
Yeah.
No one likes to hear
that. And then just when you nail it, that little baby will change and she'll like something a bit different.
Exactly.
Like she might have fed a nurse to sleep, and then she'll tell you she doesn't want a nurse to sleep. She'd rather you just left her alone.
Exactly. And you're going, well, damn it, I just figured it out. But
yeah.
And, you know, it's just always ever changing, and you've always, you know, kind of on the tip of your toes. And right when you sit back, no, they're going to drag you away again into a new direction. So, but that's part of the fun journey of it all, I think, too. If you can embrace that aspect of it, it can actually be incredibly fascinating and interesting to watch them change and grow that way.
And we often seem to be just, you know, half a step behind, and then they teach us if we listen to them. They do teach us what they need next.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we've talked about the babies. Now, what about us? What about the parents? How's evolution equipped us to raise these happy, healthy, I love what you said on your website, happy, healthy, moral, empathic and intelligent children? That's a pretty good goal.
It's a very good goal, and one I think we should all be striving for. Well, I think there's several ways, and in fact, actually a lot of them I think have less to do with the parent than the baby, and we've just kind of lost sight of a lot of it. So at the very basic level, babies are evolutionarily primed to be cute. We want to be close to them. We want to look at them. We want to be near them and care for them no matter what they do, just because they are so freaking cute. And that's hugely important, and I think people underestimate how important it is that we find babies cute, because it keeps them alive. At another level, their cries. They have cries that are actually designed to make us want to stop it. And there's a lot of research that mothers' reactions to her own baby's cries are actually qualitatively different than that to another baby's cry, despite being the same intensity and everything. So they can manipulate the intensity and the sounds, and to a stranger, the two will sound equally obnoxious or equally annoying or equally easy to block out, because it is much easier to block out the cry of another baby. But mothers themselves have it seemingly innate that they need to try and stop it in a positive way. And I think we also have, babies have very soft skin, and I think this is one of the most important things when we talk about babies and touch. And I know I will be talking more about touch with you, and you've talked about it, I've talked about it on our sites. It's one of those big things. Babies need to be touched. They need to be held. And they actually have evolutionarily evolved to have the soft, soft skin that elicits touch. You talk about, I mean, you imagine those babies' soft skin, when you just want to touch it all the time. My daughter likes to run around naked. I just love grabbing her arms, not grabbing in a bad way, but as she goes by, I like stroking her arms and her bum and her feet, and they're just, the skin is so soft to the touch, but we give them so much information and love and care, and they get so much sensory input from touch. And by keeping it soft, we want to be gentle with it. It kind of primes us to be gentle with their skin and in turn with them. And then there's two other things that I think are really big for us as parents, and they both have to do with oxytocin, which, if people don't know what it is, it's the hormone that kind of elicits love and bonding and empathy. And it's present both in a natural birth, most generally when we birth our babies vaginally and naturally, we get a high peak of oxytocin at the end of it. And this allows us to actually form this bond with the baby right at the beginning. And one of the things I worry about are these changing birthing practices and how they influence it, because as necessary as they are and as much as they save lives at times, their overuse and their use when they're not kind of indicated to better outcomes for mom and baby, things like Pitocin, the synthetic version of oxytocin, we know inhibits the natural production of oxytocin post-birth. Similarly, epidural sometimes can influence that as well. And there's mixed results on that, more seeming to do potentially with the dosage of epidural and how much goes in, but that does seem to influence also our own development of oxytocin. So if we kind of stop that bonding process right at birth, how is that affecting the way in which we parent our babies right from the get-go? Similarly, breastfeeding elicits oxytocin, and that's something else we see drastically on the decline. And the act of breastfeeding actually helps keep that bond going. So when we immediately tell people to supplement, some need it, some don't, but we know it's one of the booby traps that keeps breastfeeding rates lower. And we need to be careful about what we're doing, because we are influencing some of the most natural evolved ways for parents to care most about their babies.
Mm-hmm. I'm just fascinated listening to you.
Sorry. Yeah, I know, that's
what I'm
going on there.
She's going, I love that, because the oxytocin is just so amazing, and that's why if birth is tricky, doesn't go well for you, I know you're going to be talking about touch, but that's where the skin-to-skin comes in, because it starts that oxytocin happening again. You know, like, we can still do things to, if we know that it's made a difference, we can work on that difference and improve things again. But if we don't know and nobody talks about it, we could miss that beautiful little window.
Well, I remember I did a piece on So You're Going to Bottle Feed. Because a lot of people have to bottle feed. And whether it's formula or express breast milk or breast milk from another mother, it's a very common and normal thing to have to go through. And parents shouldn't feel guilty about it. And what they found was some of the bonding issues and the elicitation of oxytocin in breastfeeding is predominantly from both the skin to skin, as you mentioned, but also eye contact. And there's a study that found that mothers who bottle feed just often, because I don't know if it's the lack of the latch or the lack of the skin touching, all you need to do is just make a concerted effort to look at your baby. So there's ways to overcome these because, as you said, we know what they are. And so if you are bottle feeding, no problem, but maybe you make the extra effort just to ensure you have that skin-to-skin experience when you are feeding. And if it means taking your shirt off when you're at home and getting your bubs close to you, then great. That's all that it needs. And you've suddenly kind of overridden that step and taken yourself one step closer to what we've been evolutionarily designed to do to care for our babies.
Absolutely. And I've had mums who, one of my baby massage classes was interesting because it was like a 3 or 4 week course. And one mum who had had a very difficult surgical birth, and then other people were feeding her baby when she came to, and she'd previously had cancer, so she had a low immune system, and her she got an awful infection. So lots of things had gone wrong for this poor woman, who herself had been breastfed till she was 3 years old, so she knew very well what she wanted to do to her baby. But she'd rung me and said, I don't feel like my baby's mine. I feel like the real mother's going to come and pick her up one day. Do you think massage would help? And I said, I absolutely think massage would help, but, you know, yes, come along and see for yourself if it works for you. And we talked about skin to skin and bathing with her baby and all those lovely things. And she was trying to express but not expressing very much. But within another week or 10 days, her milk supply came up to full. Mm-hmm. And she had been given some concert tickets before her baby was born to somebody really fabulous. And she said to me, oh, these tickets, you know, and she was really confused about whether she should go to the concert. And I started to laugh. I said, you know what's happened? Because her fear about going to the concert was about leaving her baby. And I said, you know what's happened? You've bonded.
Exactly.
And now you don't want to leave your baby. You said you didn't feel as though this was your baby, you know, but you've bonded. And she was, you know, expressing enough milk to almost fully give her baby breast milk by this day.
So wonderful.
So, you know, things worked really well, but it was just, if you can override the trauma, and in our big series, we have got somebody who's going to be talking about that too. So, you know, when babies have been ill, when mother's been ill, any interruptions, if you know what you're doing, it often is about the oxytocin. And even with toddlers, you know, the sitting cuddling when you're overwhelmed with your child is enough to bring your balance and their balance back, isn't it? Like it's
exactly,
a terribly powerful chemical.
Advocation for the time in versus the time out is exactly that, is being able to be there and help use your body to help regulate theirs as well.
Mm.
And it's hugely important, I think, for kids to have that sense that they can come to you for that type of regulation.
Yeah, and it starts with these little babies. Now,
mm-hmm.
we've got another point here, the common parenting advice that is at odds with optimum infant development and why. I think most people here will guess what that might be, but have an explanation about this.
Well, I think, you know what, there's a couple things here, and I think there's one that people might not think of, but we'll start with the most common one that I think everyone thinks of, and that's baby training. And we'll start with the fact that I want to start with the idea that, okay, what is optimum infant development? And if we think of it, I think, evolutionarily speaking, babies are developed, or they've evolved to develop optimally under the conditions with which we have evolved. And none of that has included baby training. Babies have been doing what babies have been supposed to do for hundreds of thousands of years. And suddenly we're messing with it. And at a very specific level, we look at something like crying it out, which is probably the most common form when people talk about baby training, or controlled crying for that matter, but you're being taught that you're just going to ignore your baby's distress. So when we talk about optimal development, how is it optimal for any of us to learn if no one's listening to us? If no one's responsive to us, what message are we getting, and is that at all good for our development? And I would argue no, it's not good for babies, it's not good for kids, it's not good for teenagers, and it's not good for adults. If we learned we're not being listened to, we develop learned helplessness. A second area in which training seems to come in and just seems completely counter to all levels of development is in terms of scheduling feeds and sleep. That somehow babies should be sleeping on a schedule like us right away, which we know they're not biologically equipped to do. And some babies simply take longer, and they need to do that on their own time. Their brain, their circadian rhythm develops at a slower rate than others. Their brain is still developing, and their need for sleep changes over development. And some of them take till about 3 before they're even close to sleeping through the night. And some take beyond 3. So I think we really have this huge range that we have to just accept that their bodies know what they're doing. In terms of feeds, I mean, you're a lactation consultant. You know how big a baby's stomach is.
the size of a marble when it's first born and the size of a little golf ball or your baby's tiny little fist when it's, you know, a month old. It's going to need frequent feeding, and those mothers have different breast milk storage capacities that I think people aren't explaining, that, you know, it's not, if you had to get, say, a litre of liquid in 24 hours and you were pouring it into a shot glass, you'd need a lot of refills. And if you imagine the shot glass is mum's breast, if mum had jugs, you might get away with your 4-hourly schedule, but we're all different.
We're all very different. And also with that, I mean, I think people don't realize that breast milk is much lower in protein and fat than not only some other mammalian milks, but formula as well, which means baby goes through it faster. Our milk has evolved for frequent feedings. For whatever the reason, and the fact of the matter is we don't know the reason our milk has lower fat and protein content, but it is for our brains and our bodies as babies, it is ideal. It is normal. It is optimal. It is the way it is supposed to be. And for that reason, we have to accept that there is a reason that it doesn't have that, even if we don't yet actually know what that is, although I know there are tons of researchers working on trying to figure that out. But I think all these things kind of highlight, all the training works to highlight that somehow we expect babies to be what they're not, which is independent very early. And unfortunately, I think it's at odds with optimum infant development, primarily because I think it creates the exact opposite of a lot of anxiety and dependence in some children. This isn't what people want, but yet this is what we're actually teaching them through these type of parenting practices. But I think the other one that kind of leads to this and that parents may not think of is that the parenting, and I'm not sure it's necessarily advice, but it does stem under our cultural views of parenting, and that's that somehow we're supposed to be doing this alone and without help. And families are isolated from others, and a parent who stays at home is isolated. And people really don't get the sense of community and help that they used to have. People don't necessarily live as close to their families anymore, and that's one of the biggest problems is we've lost alloparents in the sense of grandparents and aunts and uncles and very close community members who can come by kind of at the drop of a hat and help with what needs to be helped with. And because we know that that lack of social support leads to increased postpartum depression, I think we have a lot of parents that are now searching for the quick fix, which is where this other parenting advice comes in. So I think unless we start to deal with the solitary parenting problem, I don't think we're going to have a lot of success fighting some of the other battles about this common parenting advice, just because I don't think we're giving parents the tools to be able to parent in an optimum way in the society in which we live.
That's an excellent point. Now, I visited 3 mums last year who live within a block of each other, and I said to each of them who had babies the same age, you know, I can see this is really hard for you. Have you talked about it in your mother's group? And each one of these women said, and they probably went to the same mother's group. We have organized groups when mothers have a new baby here. And they said, oh no, everybody else is far too together. I couldn't possibly, you know, tell them how hard I'm finding it.
It's really sad
because the isolation just perpetuates.
And I bet you anything, if one of them said something, it would kind of break a mold and everyone would just be like, oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, I had a bad night too.
Yeah, I've been sitting here saying it's great with a smile on my face after 5 coffees. So thank you, someone finally said it.
Yeah, somebody out loud. I was at a mum's group and my kids were little and we were going around the circle. The facilitator had asked us to, you know, come up with one good thing we'd done with our child that week. And I was actually up to the third child thinking, I'm not sure what I can say this week. It's been a wet week and we've been stuck inside. And the woman next to me who was new said, well, I've had a crap week. I haven't done the washing and I'm wearing my husband's underpants. And everybody felt so much better after that.
Exactly. And you know what? There's that saying, misery loves company. And in a sense, it's true, not in a bad way, but it's so nice to know you're not alone in it, that everyone has these moments. And with it come, everyone has these amazing moments too, hopefully.
And a bad moment doesn't make a bad parent.
Exactly. I couldn't have said it better. That's exactly it. Everyone has bad moments. We've all had moments we wish we could take back. And, you know, the point is to kind of learn from them and try and move forward with it. Not to ignore them, not to pretend they didn't happen, because I think you do need to look at what led to it. Do I need more support? Do I need to talk to someone else to get, you know, some help in here? What can you do to try and avoid them? Because we do want to avoid them. But even when we do all we can to avoid them, they're going to come bite us in the ass again. And that's just because it's the way life seems to go. we can't control everything.
Doing such a big job with children and babies, you get tired or you get meshed out. You know, you get run down, you get burnt out, and it's just a sign that the fire's been burning a little bit hard, that we're burnt out, isn't it?
And that's why I say, like, when people have come to me, I do say you do need to look at what went wrong, and often what went wrong is simply you lost track of taking care of yourself in all of it. And you got a bit too tired, and sometimes you can do something about it, and sometimes you can't. And it's unfortunate that sometimes we can't, but I think if we start doing something when we can, it, you know, really does reduce the times when we can't. And if it's just, you know, a lay-in on the weekend, will you arrange for someone to spend an hour with your baby or your partner or your grandparent or your very close friend? If it's, you know, instead of a lie-in, an hour-long shower, if that's what does it for you, then that's, you know, what you need to try and make sure you're getting the small things that allow you to kind of be a parent at the best of your capacity.
That's right. Now, we'll go on. The four interactions that are most important for wiring your baby's developing brain.
Yes.
How easy these are to implement. I mean, we're not telling you to do something that's hard and terrible, or you have to go out and get textbooks or anything like that. It's just some easy things that you can do.
Yes.
And you've sort of touched on those because when you were talking about what babies need and how babies are evolved to make us do these or to elicit this care. So let's go a little bit deeper into these. And the first one, obviously, is touch.
Exactly. Well, touch is, I don't think we can stress how important it is. And it's, unfortunately, I think people ignore how little touch babies are getting. So there was a study, actually, that looked at the amount of touch that Western babies were getting on average. And for the youngest of infants, they were spent only 12 to 20% of their days being touched by another human being. And that number had reduced to less than 10% by the time the baby turned one. So our one-year-olds are spending over 90% on average of their time not being touched by another person. And that is, so not
that's
good
horrendous.
For their brain development.
That's shocking, isn't it? Because you need that touch to elicit the chemicals that are going to fire and wire those little brains.
Exactly. And, you know, I like to think of it that when you just get down to the basics of how important touch is to preemies and babies in NICU, and you look at kangaroo care and how successful it has been in saving lives, and you say, well, okay, we see the impact. We know this impact. Why do we not think it extends to full-term babies and infants and toddlers and children and adults? I mean, we've even started looking at the importance of touch on adults and how little we get, but how much just, I think it was something like 8 hugs a day. Brief hugs. They don't need to be long hugs. 8 hugs a day changes a person's physiology and happiness level because of that. That's how little touch we're getting as adults. And so our infants who are constantly developing and need this kind of input from us, they need the touch. And especially because that's the kind of information about what we feel for them. They don't understand language early. They understand sounds and stuff, but they don't actually understand the words we're saying. And so we can say, I love you, till we're blue in the face. But picking them up and holding them gently and close and skin to skin gives them that information in such a better way. So that's, I think, one reason we really need to be careful of that and really work to touch our infants. And it doesn't mean you have to co-sleep. It doesn't mean you have to do any of those things, but that you take the concerted effort to make sure that you're touching your baby as much as you possibly can. So that would be number one for me. The second one is holding your baby while they're crying. And I know it's so hard for parents, and it's hard for anyone to hold a baby who's crying, especially if you're not being successful at stopping that crying at the moment. And it can be incredibly infuriating. But the reason it's so important for neurological development is that we know that when babies cry for extended periods, when left alone, they get a spike in cortisol in the brain. It spikes it, and we know it's not good for neural development, et cetera. But what research found that kind of shocked people is that when babies were in arms and crying, that spike didn't happen. So they could cry for 2 hours, and you didn't see that cortisol level spike when they were actually being held and gently cared for by a caregiver during that crying period. So when we talk about the neural development, the ability to stop stress from affecting the brain, our ability to hold our babies and hold them, especially when they're distressed, is key to their optimal neural development. And then the third one I would say is really big is stimulation, and rather overstimulation with respect to toys for babies. I don't know why we need toys for babies. It boggles the mind, and yet it's sadly a bunch of psychologists who come up with, you know, developmentally appropriate toys, and we're teaching your baby skills they need. No. Babies.
Those psychologists work for big corporations who make toys.
Exactly.
I won't mention any names. But
yeah, exactly. And it's, but they don't. They need human, they need eye-to-eye contact. They need to see human faces. They need to watch you engage in your world. Even if you're not engaging with them at the moment, there's a little term benign neglect. And many cultures do it, where the babies don't get all this face-to-face kind of interactions the way we interact with babies. They're kind of just part of the mom, and they see everyone. They get eye contact. They get to look at faces. But it's not kind of speaking to them as a baby. They're just kind of part of what's going on. And they learn so much about the environment. They're out in nature, and that's a really important thing, too, for babies, is you bring them out, and you can put them down on a blanket at the park or in a wrap on your back or on your stomach and look up at a tree. That baby can see something incredible and complex and full of information for him or her with something that simple. And, in fact, if you actually sit back and look at it, too, it's quite fascinating. I've learned to do that myself, and it's really, it is so much more interesting than a toy that lights up because you press a button. And a toy that lights up when you press a button doesn't teach cause and effect. I hate to say it, but no, it teaches a baby a repetitive action that leads to something. Cause and effect is learned from a parent being responsive. So when we talk about those toys, parenting is really the way to teach those developmental skills and getting the toys away from babies and having them really focus on natural stimuli, being humans, being nature, being just even what's around the house is interesting enough, but it's simple enough for them and complex enough for them. So I think that's kind of the third really big thing that is really important for babies and their brain development. And then the last that I would say, and I hate saying it because I feel it always gets people, I think, to feel a bit defensive at first, but I'm going to say it's breastfeeding or getting a baby breast milk. And the reason I say is that we know there are elements in breast milk that are really important for brain development that they have not been able to replicate because we don't understand them in formula. And so what I always like to advocate is that I don't think any parent that chooses formula is bad or horrible. People choose it for myriad reasons, some because they have had trouble breastfeeding, some because they simply can't for medical reasons, some because they just choose not to. There are really a lot of valid reasons not to breastfeed, and I think we forget about that in the overarching topic of breastfeeding and feeding a baby. But where I think we need to start focusing on it is making it accessible for babies to have access to breast milk, even if it's not the mother's. And I know there are milk banks, but they're usually so focused on getting the milk to the preemies and those who truly need it that parents find they can't do it. And this is where I think organizations like Human Milk for Human Babies and Eats on Feets really do well with connecting mothers who can help each other out with that regard. And I think we need to make milk sharing more feasible for people, which may mean implementing low-cost testing for families who want to have the breast milk tested before giving it to their babies, and to make it more affordable and to make it more accessible. And frankly, I think we need to make it more acceptable. People really seem to get weirded out by the idea of another mother providing milk for their baby, and we need to stop that because it's so normal and it's what women have done for so long. Whenever a mother had a problem breastfeeding, someone else would take up that task for her, and we really need to think about getting back to that to get babies what they need. Reserve formula for cases where it's absolutely necessary. So those would be my four things, I think, for infant neural development that really makes a difference, and I think if we could get to them, we might see a lot of a difference in baby behaviors.
They're all really, you know, really good, really simple, aren't they? Apart from perhaps the breastfeeding might be hard for some people, but the other things are very, very easy. We don't need expensive equipment. We don't need fancy toys. We don't need anything else. We've got it all within us. And I'm just going to introduce this new series that we're going to do because we're, well, we're actually a little bit over halfway, thank goodness. I'm looking at the time thinking, oh, well, we'll go over. It's all right.
Oh, God, we are, aren't we?
We'll go over a bit. That's all right. I know, I'm sure everybody else is quite happy now. Just if you're enjoying yourself today listening to Tracy's information, you can dive deeper. We've actually got some fabulous, we're going to do a series, and this series includes experts in early development and learning with lots of practical suggestions, just like Tracy's giving you, to help enrich your baby's environment and support this foundation for early learning to set your baby up for life, really. Now, when we do this, we've got these experts. I'll just tell you who they are. We talked about Kangaroo Mother Care. We have got Dr. Nils Bergman from Johannesburg, who is the absolute guru on Kangaroo Mother Care, and he's going to talk about birth and the critical period, but how the earliest sensations you give your baby do actually fire those brain pathways and how you can set the thermostat for optimal cortisol release and infant brain development and what to do if it doesn't all go right. We've got Dr. Darcia Navez, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana, USA, and she's going to be talking about wiring baby brains for trust and love and happiness. And we have, if things have gone wrong for you, you'll be really interested in this one. We have got Dr. Campbell Paul. He's a consultant infant and child psychiatrist at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, and he also runs the Masters in Infant Mental Health program at Melbourne University. And he actually, which scared a few people, I think, I know it scared you, Tracy, when I mentioned it, he's actually treated babies with depression. So he's going to talk to, we're going to ask him about restoring trust after trauma, because I've actually had mothers who've asked me, you know, my baby's had a lot of medical treatment early on and I'm really worried how this has impacted on my baby's brain. If you've been unwell with depression, you might be just a bit worried whether that connection came more slowly, or if you've done baby training in the past, if you've done controlled crying, you might be worried about what do we do now to override those things that we've done. So we'll be asking Campbell Paul about those sorts of things, and then we're going to finish up with Sarah Ockwell-Smith. She's the founder and director of Baby Calm UK, and she's written a beautiful book called Baby Calm, and she's going to be able to talk to us. We'll be discussing more of the practical things you can actually do, like understanding and working with your newborn sleep patterns, you know, what colic is and what it isn't and how to soothe it. So you'll get the lovely deep information, and then you'll get the very practical stuff, mother-to-mother stuff at the end. Now, also what we're going to do when you register for this one, you'll also get, we're offering an early bird discount, which means you can get the whole series for just $29, which is almost ridiculous. And you'll also get free that you can download straight away. I've got a recording package on my website called Early Loving, Early Learning,
Loving Ways to Make Your Baby Smarter. And this one I actually had transcribed. So you've got transcripts and recordings. And this series is more about the more physical development of children, but also the emotional development. But it doesn't cross over this. It's actually complementary to this one. So you'll get that package of 6 recordings absolutely straight up as soon as you register for the series. And, of course, you'll get the recordings for the whole series as well, just as you're getting for this one if you haven't been on the call. So I'll give you a little bit more information about that, how you actually register in a moment. But, you know, that means you get these 2 seminar series, all for the price of 1, and we can do that. Now, we'll just go on. We've got 5 ways. I'm going to ask Tracy now. 5 ways you can increase your little one's capacity for social, emotional and neurological development. And we've talked about touch, but also there's positive touch, isn't there?
There is, and I think that's, we speak about the importance of touch, and here where positive touch is learning not only how to read other people's emotions from touch, which they do very well early on, but providing them kind of the information about also how to touch others in a positive way. So by us, you know, teaching our children kind of this gentle touch and how to elicit love and care from our touch to them, we not only are giving them a sense of loving themselves, but also how they can then pass that on to other children and other people that they meet, which I think is really important for their long-term social development. But our touch also helps them develop their own sense of emotion regulation. So their emotional development themselves is coming externally at first from us. And the way in which we touch them really influences that. So I think that's actually probably one of the biggest things. Tied with that would be 2, I think, which is responsiveness and respecting a baby's needs. There's one thing to know your baby has needs. They need to sleep. They need to do whatever. And it's another to respect the way in which they need us to help them. And I think it's, again, this push for independence that we have so strongly for babies that we kind of forget that they need us to help them on that path. And without us, they will struggle. So I always hate this term, you know, the self-soothing argument, which is why everyone claims they're doing crying it out. They need to just learn to self-soothe. And oddly, actually, I had a professor comment to me the other day on that one, and I just kind of jumped down her throat. I'm like, no, they don't learn to self-soothe.
That's not what we call it here.
But it's when we respect their needs and they seek from us both dependence, and this is where, you know, the self-soothing fallacy is that they need us to kind of teach them how to regulate their emotions. And how to socialize with others. And we have to respect their need to come to us. But we also, in turn, have to respect their need for independence. And I think that can be very hard for parents as well. When younger babies start to push away for a moment, they get upset. They don't want you to touch them. They don't want you to help them. Some of our overriding instincts are to know, I must hold you and make it better. And yet, that's also a form of non-responsiveness because we're not listening to what they need at that moment. They have in their mind away, and this comes a bit later in development, usually just past 1. But I've heard people comment that they have babies that are like this too, that truly don't want to be picked up at a given moment. And I think it's really important that we listen to what they're telling us about that and start to figure out what it is they need, why they need it, because as we respect their boundaries, they're going to start respecting other people's boundaries. And we know that our babies and children's and even as adults, our ability to interact with others and have these healthy social relationships is dependent upon our ability to actually listen to other people and respect their boundaries as well. So I think that's one of the ways in which we can really try and work with that, which is this respecting them both when they need dependence and not kind of dismissing it and forcing independence on them, but also respecting their independence when they need it as well. I think the third thing that we really need for kids is empathy. And this is what, I mean, you mentioned it earlier on as I look at evolutionary factors that influence empathy. And one of the things that it just drives me bonkers, and I see it so often, and my poor husband, when I was going over my points with him, he had to kind of cringe because he was very guilty of this with his first son, and he completely acknowledges kind of some of the problems with it that happened, is we don't want our children to see pain. When they see someone who's upset, one of the first instincts I see regularly amongst parents here is they tell the kid, oh, no, don't worry, they're fine. And these children are growing up with a sense of other people's pain and other people's negative emotions either don't matter or aren't real. And I think that's really detrimental to their ability to grow both emotionally as themselves, but also when they interact with other people. And we need to allow ourselves to help our children label emotions and be okay with negative emotions. It's okay to be angry, and it's okay to be sad, and it's okay for someone else to be angry. It's not okay for us to hit you when we're angry, just as we like to tell children, it's also, you know, not necessarily great if you hit us, although hitting is, at their age, much more common than I think we'd like and can serve a purpose in their kind of social pecking order, but I'll get to that. But it's the way in which we express our emotions may be important, but to dismiss emotions out of hand, I think, can be really detrimental. I don't know if you've had that or seen that in parents where you are, where they try and get kids to kind of...
Oh, be quiet. I'll give you something to cry about.
Yeah, well, there's that too. Yeah, and that's the other part of it is, so we tell them, you know, those people aren't upset, don't worry about it. And then we tell them, if you get upset, we're going to, you know, I'll make you even more upset. And all of this, our discussions of emotions are so warped with them.
Stop that now, you know.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and we wonder, and then they say it to other kids too. They completely ignore other people's sadness, and do we wonder why? They've learned that. So I think for emotional development, it's absolutely critical that we not only accept their emotions, we don't necessarily have to accept the expression of emotion when it's dangerous or really might hurt someone else or themselves. Obviously, that's when you have to step in. But you have to accept the emotion itself and let them know that it's okay to feel certain ways. And then you have to allow them to understand that other people feel that way too. And it takes some turning because even though they're born, babies are born hardwired to be empathic with other babies. I mean, it's the cry response. One baby cries and suddenly you've got a room full of crying babies.
Absolutely.
It's the innate empathy that they have. And then we seem to kind of knock it out of them. And we're getting children entering school who truly don't have that sense of empathy because I think they've had it trained out. Both because of their own emotional state and because of how we try to respond to them with other people being upset, telling them to ignore other people's sadness as well. So I think that that's one of the biggest things, I think, for long-term emotional and social development and neurological, I think, too, especially from their own their own emotional point of view, allowing them to express their emotions, because the more they have to hold them in, we know that is incredibly stressful on the body and brain. So that's no good at all. And then I mentioned just before these interactions with other kids, I'm not going to say that babies at 3 months of age need other kids. I'm not going to say even at a year or at 18 months. But the toddler years, by about between three and five, and sometimes earlier, children start actively seeking out interactions with other children. And when you allow them to follow that, and you allow them to have peer-to-peer interactions without adult intervention, except when safety is an issue, you let them solve their problems. It will involve some hitting. It may involve some grabbing. It may involve all the things we don't want to see. But that's them working it out. And it's them learning a whole lot about social encounters with their peers. And as long as no one's getting hurt, those are the kind of things, us stepping in constantly, we dictate the way they behave with their peers. They don't learn to behave with their peers on their own. And I think that's really problematic in terms of long-term social well-being. And as I said, clearly you need to step in at some times. This is absolutely not an advocation that we should let children beat each other up till they're bloody and bruised, but the occasional grabbing something from someone's hand they will work it out on their own. There are natural consequences that will happen when they grab something and how they play with someone else. And it's important to be aware of age differences. And I think where people sometimes get a little upset at the thought of this is that they see older children who will take from younger, and they don't want to teach their younger children or their older children that you can either be bullied by older kids or you can be a bully so long as you're bigger. And it's so hard because the way we've raised our kids, we almost do get that. But when children have been raised to kind of always respect the needs of someone younger than them, they grow up kind of aware of babies. They grow up surrounded by other children and babies. They learn kind of the limitations. They have natural empathy for kids. And there's a program called The Roots of Empathy, which takes place in classrooms in Canada and the U.S. I don't know, is it in Australia? Do you have that?
What's it called? Roots of Empathy.
Yeah.
No.
So, well, what it is it's an attempt to stop bullying. And what they found does it is they recruit mothers who are due to have a baby kind of end of August. And starting in September, they bring in the newborn to the classroom for a visit once a month. And these children in the classroom learn about babies. They learn about how helpless they are. And they watch them grow and what they start to accomplish on their own. And it takes them through the school year. And it's been wildly successful by every stretch of the imagination. It's truly helping children understand the limits of younger children. And in turn, they're better understanding and have greater empathy for not only younger children, but same-age peers as well. And so when we have children that are actually raised in an environment with other children and younger children, and they learn to respect that a younger child does need special consideration because of their age, you tend not to see that type of bullying, grabbing behavior of the larger to the younger. And so we need to kind of have an overhaul shift with that. But in terms of an individual level, you raise your children to understand that younger babies need special consideration and you can't grab things from them. And the reasons why, when they see how limiting a baby is and how much they are dependent upon other people, then you have children who won't engage that way even with their peers. And so those natural consequences can actually start to take effect. So I think that the interactions are so important with other kids and multi-age kids as well, that being able to, like I said, understand these younger children, but also looking up to older children and seeing what they do. So the greater age range we can have with children, the greater it influences their social and their emotional development as well. And then the final one here is, I think it's ditching punishment. I think when we talk about wanting to socialize our children to have healthy relationships, to have appropriate emotion regulation and neurological development, I think we have to kind of ditch the notion that we need to punish our children for the way they behave in favor of working with our children and helping them learn. And I mean, it all stems from discipline, and I think people forget that discipline stems from disciple, which is someone who is learning from you to teach. Exactly. And so we want to be teaching. We want to be teaching our children. We don't want to punish our children because most of the time they haven't done something wrong in our eyes. And if we can reframe their actions, even ourselves, to help understand what they're doing, then every time we can reframe it, we're able to kind of get down to their level and say, oh, okay, so this is what you're trying to do. Now let's try and redirect and talk about why it might not be appropriate, talk about what else we can do in the moment. So I had an incident the other day. My daughter, we were sitting out on the deck, my husband and I, and she was playing in her sandbox and then going to get dirt, I guess it was, and she decided she just wanted to pour it all on us. And it was getting utterly frustrating. And we're sitting there trying to have a chat and a nice glass of wine at that. And she's just coming up and pouring sand on us and thinks it's the funniest thing on the face of the earth. She had a pair of salad tongs to pick it up and then was putting it on us. And we just kept saying, stop, stop. And I was at the stage where I just wanted to be like, I'm going to grab the salad tongs away and be like, just no, no more. And I stopped myself and I went inside for a moment and I thought about it and I said, you know what? I've got a 3-year-old who is thrilled and entertaining herself wildly with a pair of salad tongs and dirt. Like, that's pretty awesome. And not only that, but she's having so much fun, she wants to share it with us. And as soon as I could see it that way, I kind of came back out. I saw the enjoyment. We allowed her to continue, but then we started talking like, okay, well, you know, mommy doesn't really like having the dirt on her, but who might like the dirt? And we looked around. Oh, look at the plants over there. I think the plants would love the dirt being poured. So suddenly it became a great game of going to get the dirt and pouring it on the plants. And who else might like it? Oh, look at that leaf over there. Or look at the worms over in the garden there. They might like the dirt. And as soon as we could get away and kind of reframe the action and get away from, I must punish her for doing this, not only could I kind of see her, but I could, we used it almost to teach her about, okay, who likes dirt? And let her keep going with that. So I think that's really important, the reframing and getting away from the idea that they're doing things to bug us and that we need to punish them for it. And accepting that their behaviors are often entirely age appropriate, but also that they're coming from a sense of wonder and learning. That our kids are constantly doing things to try and teach themselves about the world. And so whether it bugs us or not, we have to accept that that is something that is really big for them. And once we do that, we can help them do it in a way that may not drive us as crazy.
That's a really, really lovely example, isn't it? Because you could actually get so annoyed that your child was paying you to do it. But as soon as you redirect them, and that's all you really need to do. It's not that hard, is it? And whereas
no.
if you come up against a small child like that and keep saying no and trying to stop them and take the salad tongs off them, you're going to have a tantrum anyway.
Oh, you're going to have
a tantrum. You're going to have to fix it.
We would have stopped what was really a learning experience for her.
Absolutely.
Like she was learning something for herself, and we're going to say that, no, we're ending everything. And we didn't need to end the entire game. All that needed to happen was that something needed to be redirected.
Yeah.
And it needed us to calm down first and see that, no, she's not doing this intentionally. She's not trying to piss us off. She's thinking it's a game and that we're, you know, you know, doing the, oh, no, I don't like this, the way sometimes we do when we play things that are, you know, we're joking around and she'll like, look, Mom, pretend poo, and she puts it on you and you go, ah, gross. But she knows we're playing then. So she doesn't know the distinction of when we're playing at that point saying, oh, gross, versus here saying, oh, stop. Like, it's all the same to her. And, you know, it's up to us to remember that and treat them appropriately with that.
Right, yeah, totally. So it's learning instead of punishment. And we have gone over time, but that's all right.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's okay with me. No, I'm loving it. So we'll leave people today with the single best thing, and you've probably alluded to this, you've mentioned it, but the single best thing you can do to set your baby's happiness factor for life. And again, it's no equipment or teaching aids required, just a parent.
It's a parent being responsive and learning your baby and being there for your baby. And I think when we're responsive to them, I mean, when we look at the literature and we forget terms like attachment parenting and everything else, we look at secure attachment. And we look at empathy, and those are really probably the two biggest that we need to focus on. Both of them, the single best predictor of your child's empathy later on for other people and your child's attachment status as being a securely attached child stems from responsive parenting. And that's it. It just comes through so strongly, it's almost ridiculous that we would ever suggest that people do anything but be responsive. And yet, obviously, there's a multi-billion-dollar industry telling people not to be. But we know that's exactly what it is, that children's empathy levels are set by being responded to because they learn, you know, that is how they control their emotions and they learn things. They learn they're worthy. They learn they are worth something to their parents, that their parents care about them, that they can go back to them. And that's such an important lesson that we want our children to have. So I think that's really all there is to it. And touch is hugely important and fits in so many ways with responsiveness because it is the best way to calm a baby is via, gentle touch. But it's not enough. You still need to be responsive in a way that's appropriate to what your baby needs.
That's right. Yep. Yep, so responsive parenting. And I love that you've given us all of this beautiful research in the background too. And it's not just, you know, an airy-fairy concept of loving children and being responsive to them. And yet, sadly, there is so much pressure against it. And yet there's no evidence to go against it. It's just...
Oh, and all the evidence completely supports it. It's
completely supports being responsive to your baby and all these beautiful things you've talked about today. So that, thank you so much, Tracy. Now, if people want more information, they go to your website, which is?
It's www.evolutionaryparenting.com. And we also have a Facebook page, which is parents usually often ask questions and stuff, just as you do too. So you can just look us up under Evolutionary Parenting if interested. And yeah, those
and you
are
have a newsletter too, which is great.
We do. That's right. I forgot about that.
That's a great one. Yes,
that's what I did with my newsletter. I just kind of threw it in, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. No, it's the newsletter is just a post. It comes once a week on Wednesdays. It's just the post from the previous week, so that if people don't want to actually have to go and check every day, and I'm not one of those people, so I always appreciate the summary things. But, yeah, it get delivered to your inbox, and you can read what you choose and ignore what you don't want to read. But, yeah, that's so, yes, we have a little newsletter, which you can sign up on the website. It's just on the right-hand side, I want to say, on the main page going down. So you just put your email address in. It'll ask you to confirm, and that's something I will say. If you do sign up, please look for the confirmation email. I do get emails about that saying they – signed up and haven't gotten it, but then apparently they never actually confirmed their email. So,
yes, that's so making sure real people get it.
Exactly, yes, which I do appreciate, but at the same time, I think it's harder if sometimes I think those confirmation ones go into spam. So,
I think they do too sometimes.
They do,
yeah.
Yes. So, yeah, and that's that. And I have to say, I am very excited to hear the rest of the talks because I think what you've got are people who.
We've got
as I know all of their work.
We've got the cream of the crop, and I was blown away when they all said yes. I'm going, oh, well, I always do this. I write my dream list out, and then I go find these people, and I go, yes. We've definitely got the best in the business here.
Oh, it's fantastic what you've got coming up. It is very. I had the joy of actually doing a brief interview with Darsha when we were both at the Society for Research and Child Development Conference. And, she's wonderful. And, I mean, I've worked with Sarah, too, who I just adore. And I love how she brings things to the parenting level that make it just so accessible because she really seems to understand the struggles that families go through in a way to allow you to address your family needs while also addressing your baby's needs in such a practical way, which is what you do too. I mean, you two do the same thing, just on different continents. So
different continents. But yeah, when I read her book, I thought, oh, we could have written each other's books. But
exactly.
But it is lovely to have that practical stuff. When we've given all the research, then how do you tie it together? How do you do this with the baby in real life? Because it can sound incredibly idealistic when you hear all of the research and you think, how can we make it simple? So you've given the overview about, you know, what people can actually do and coming at it from a psychologist, from an academic, but from also from a mother who's really there with your child. That's gold.
It's well, thank you so much for this opportunity. This was just lovely. And for also picking a time that, you know, didn't have me getting up at 1 a.m. to sit and chat, which I was, admit, a little worried about. But I would have done it for you.
It's a bit tricky, yes. So that's what I've said to the others. You know, I will work in with your times. And if not, we will just record them earlier. And
that's true, yes.
It's okay. We've got a great facility here for recording information. And, yes, so just remember, everybody, if you want this new series, you will be sent an email. Watch your inbox again for it about how to get on this with the link. But if you want to go over there right now, because we've only got 3 days at $29 for this whole series, and then it's going to increase to $47, which is actually an absolute steal. But if you want to jump on board now while you're hot, we have never offered all of this information so cheaply, and I've had to go, and so have you probably, Tracy, to conferences for health professionals to actually hear these people speak and to meet them, and I can tell you, you don't get much out of $1,000 when you go to hear them speak. And then you
usually
have to
pay for travel. About 20 minutes, and you get a little tidbit of something, and then suddenly they're sitting back down again, and you're like, what happened?
Hang I want more.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you can have a whole hour, and you can even send email questions if you've got any for any of these particular people. And the information about them all, there's more information about them on the actual page. Now, that's pinkymckay.com/secretsofhappybabies/brightfromthestart. So that's pinkymckay.com/secretsofhappybabies/brightfromthestart. If you go there, you can start registering now if you like, but you'll get an email today very soon, and it will have that link on it. So you just click on the link and go in and grab that series while it's still very, very cheap, and you'll get the other series, the other package to download straight away. And on that, we've got some really great people too about infant development. And we have Dr. Sarah Buckley talking about pregnancy and birth and what happens with all those hormones. So we're going in more depth with everything that we've talked about today. So pop over there and grab that, and you'll get the whole lot of information. So you'll have your own special little library about baby development. And it's not about, again, I should say, it's not about making your child top of the class or hothousing your baby. That's not what it's about. It's about creating that optimal environment without stress for you or your baby, and knowing that a child who feels secure and loved and stress-free will be available for learning. And a child who's able to learn easily, make friends and manage stress because his tiny brain's hardwired in the best possible way, will be able to enjoy life. He'll be able to be considerate and empathic to other people. He'll be able to contribute. And that's what we all want for our kids, isn't it, really?
Exactly. Yeah, no, I think there's far too much focus on the cognitive achievement these days, and we've just
and you just can't do that if you're not emotionally available for learning.
Exactly. It's you can't do that, and it's just the world isn't all about that type of achievement. We need to be able to connect with one another as human beings, and I will leave it at that, because that's a topic for a whole other day that you're going to get into with everyone else. So.
Okay. So thank you, everybody, for being on it, and that's Tracy and Pinky. From pinkymckay.com, we're saying goodbye from now, for us for now.
And goodbye. Thank you so much.
Thank you.